This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein took office in January of 2017 in a politically divided state. The Democrat won in an election where the majority of North Carolinians voted for Republican Donald Trump. And Republicans held on to their supermajority in both houses of the state legislature, but they lost the governor's mansion. Stein has signed on to several federal cases against the Trump administration's initiatives since taking office. That includes a multi-state lawsuit to block a census question about citizenship. There are others as well. The attorney general has also taken steps to address the opioid epidemic and data breaches. Lots to talk about. Attorney General Josh Stein, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
I want to talk about all those things, but, you know, we just talked about the prison system and the kind of conviction rate among people who are charged in the prisons. I suppose, as Attorney General, what if any, authority would you have to look into that?
Well, first, I just want to thank the Charlotte Observer, the reporters you talked to. They did an immense public service by their extended and extensive series looking at the way corrections is occurring in North Carolina. In terms of my specific authority over those correctional officers who violated the law or allegedly violated the law, the way we do criminal justice in North Carolina is each local district attorney brings those charges. My authority to bring criminal charges depends on being asked by a local DA to come in, and we didn't have any referral request by any district attorney. So I cannot speak to any of the cases, whether they made the right decision to plead, to dismiss, or convict. But I think one takeaway I took from the whole series is that we really owe a duty to these correctional officers. I mean, their job, what we expect them to do, is to hold criminals, convicted folks, safe, segregated away from us so that we can be safe. So it's essential that we give them what they need so they can be safe on the job. It is an incredibly difficult job. And that means we need to have better pay for these folks so that we have fewer vacancies. When you have these vacancies, then officers end up being put in situations where it provokes violence because the prisoners see an opportunity to strike. They need better technology and they need better training. And I think that we as a state need to do better by our correctional officers.
What about, I mean, just as a lawyer and as a prosecutor, it sounds like one of the problems in this particular environment is the way in which the evidence is handled. It sounds like it's not just another criminal charge given the environment in which these charges are made. Is there any way that we have to look at sort of how we prosecute these cases?
I think prosecutors run into challenges and this is a type of case, but it's always difficult to bring a prosecution. You have witnesses, and they're susceptible to intimidation. And so I don't think it's absolutely unique. Maybe the context is a little different. There's no question. You got to weed out the bad apples. But I think the more important task for the state of North Carolina is to get more good apples into our prisons so that the guards can be safe, the prisoners can be safe, and the broader community can be safe.
Let's talk about some areas in which you do have direct jurisdiction. You signed on to a multi-state lawsuit to block a census question about citizenship. Tell us about the rationale behind that.
Sure. Having an effective census is essential. It is absolutely essential. One, it's constitutionally mandated. But two, the census is then used to allocate billions of federal dollars, whether it's in transportation, whether it's in education, whether it's in healthcare. How many people you have in your state will determine what you get back from the state, from the federal government that you pay in your taxes. Also, the population determines how many Congress people we have. And therefore, we need to know exactly how many people there are in North Carolina. By adding the question that the administration is proposing, there was no social science done to determine what the impact of adding a question about immigration status would do. All the studies indicate is that it will severely depress people's willingness, lawful immigrants as well as people who are here without proper documentation, that if you depress those numbers and you get an inaccurate count, then North Carolina as a whole is going to suffer. And my job is to protect the state of North Carolina Make sure we get our fair share.
Yeah, but don't we need to know? I mean, we pay taxes, and this goes to citizens, and the citizens of the United States are, when you talk about the allocations and the voting and districts, this is all about citizenship. So shouldn't we know who are the citizens among us?
Well, we should, and we do. There are actual follow-up questions that the census does. Right now when they do the census, it's they knock on every single door and ask every person. In off years, they will do samples where they will ask those questions, where the risks of its impact on the overall count are diminished. Things like school funding goes to a state for all the people in the state. Things like representation, congressional representation, goes to all the people in the state, immigrants and citizens. And so it is essential to have a full and accurate count. And my concern is that the administration is trying to politicize the census to steer the results to favor them. And that's not what the census is about.
Let's talk about another lawsuit. You joined 15 other Democratic attorneys general on a motion to intervene in a Texas lawsuit that challenges the Affordable Care Act. Why was that lawsuit in particular of interest to you, and why should North Carolina be part of that?
Well, hundreds of thousands of people have gotten health care through the Affordable Care Act in North Carolina, either through the individual exchange or through people who were eligible for Medicaid before now learning of their eligibility and enrolling. And so we have literally hundreds of thousands of people who have access to the health care system because of the ACA, that but for the ACA, they would not. So when these Republican attorneys general try to strike down the entire law, asserting it's unconstitutional, when it's already gone up to the U.S. Supreme Court once, I'm going to come in on the side of our health care system and the people of North Carolina whose health depends on this program.
Let's talk about yet another case. This is the president's effort to end DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Again, let me ask you why you joined that cause.
Well, again, it's about people in our state, people in North Carolina. There are 800,000 young people who are covered by the DACA program nationally, 27,000 here in North Carolina. And these are young people who were brought here on average 4, 5, or 6 years old. They've been here for many years. They've gone through to get in the program, you have to either be in school or working. So by definition, they're investing in themselves and they're building our communities. Many of them don't even know their home nation language. They came here and they learned English. And so they want nothing more than to invest in themselves so that they can strengthen our community, strengthen North Carolina. I've met with dozens of these young people, and their stories are incredibly moving, as you can imagine. I met a young guy from Durham. He went to Durham early high school at Durham Tech. He wants nothing more than to be a police officer. And I saw him interact with some of these other young people, a little bit younger than he was, in the room, who he didn't know before. And just his way of interacting with them, he was comforting them when they were crying and telling their stories. He is precisely the type of young person we want as a law enforcement officer in our communities. He will make North Carolina better. And so I want to stand up for those young people so that I'm standing up for our state.
It's very likely that a lot of people share your opinion about DACA, but the fact is by the rules of our democracy, the people of the United States, albeit a minority, elected Donald Trump. And if he's using his executive authority to change that, he has that authority, and he's the elected president. Isn't that the way our system works? Shouldn't we let the president do what the president does?
Well, the president certainly has plenty of authority, but the president, like every one of us, has to act within the confines of our Constitution and federal law. And in this instance of the DACA program, he did not do that. And there's actually an order by a court or preliminary injunction blocking his effort to abolish the program because the court concluded that we are reasonably likely to prevail, that he was acting with animus towards Mexicans, and that he did this in a way that didn't comply with federal statutory obligation of how you implement an executive order. And so I feel like it's not only the right thing to do, but the law is on our side, and that's why I took the action.
Let's talk about the role of the attorney general. There's a couple of ways to look at that, and that is the cases in which you'll have to defend the state, mm-hmm. and cases like this in which you'll join other states in sort of a broader legal challenge. Do you think the office of the attorney general has become more politicized? You know, you can read analyses that say, obviously, you get elected, so it's a political office, but that things really took a change in the 1990s when attorneys general from around the country brought the lawsuit against the tobacco industry and realized, hey, there's some power in this. Have things changed categorically since that time or from that time in terms of the way an attorney general sees his or her job?
Well, my duty as attorney general is to protect the people of North Carolina and to fulfill my oath, which is to the United States Constitution and to the laws and Constitution of North Carolina that are not in conflict with the United States Constitution. That's my duty. That's my job. That's what I try to do every day at work. It would be naive to assert that things have not become more politicized in the United States. It's just true everywhere. It's true in our North Carolina General Assembly. It's true in Washington. And I think this trend is not healthy. It's not good. I actually worked in the Attorney General's office for 8 years from 2001 to 2008 when Roy Cooper was Attorney General. And we did all kinds of multi-state actions with attorneys general from across the country, Democrat and Republican. And when the Bush administration tried to preempt or block state attorneys general from protecting their bank consumers, we got 50 states to sign on to comments that we drafted saying, no, we do have the right to protect the borrowers, the consumers in our states. We've gotten some bipartisan work done. I actually did a letter with Attorney General Pam Bondi a couple weeks ago in a letter that we sent to Congress urging them to ban mandatory arbitration in employment contracts as it relates to sexual harassment, because those mandatory arbitration provisions end up silencing victims of sexual harassment so that the harasser is free. Once they pay off that person, they're free to keep doing it. There's no good public policy for it. Well, Pam Bondi and I
She's the attorney general in Florida.
A Republican. Mm-hmm. We got 55 attorneys general, every state and district and territory within the National Association of Attorneys General to get on that letter. That was the first time in 10 years everyone had signed on to a letter. So it can happen in certain instances, but we are in a more politicized time, and I lament it. It's more than it used to be. But regardless of the circumstances, my job is still the same, which is to do what's right by the people in our state.
Well, and the state legislature, the leadership there would say your job is to defend the state whenever it is taken to court. North Carolina currently involved in 3 gerrymandering cases. What will be your role in defending the state against those charges that we have illegally gerrymandered our districts?
Those lawsuits in the main, there are legislative defendants and there's the state of North Carolina. And my job is to defend the state of North Carolina when it is sued. And so the Department of Justice is defending those laws in conjunction with the private counsel that the legislative leaders have hired. Now, I personally have withdrawn my role in those cases. I've assigned that to the Chief Deputy Attorney General, who's a career person. And I did that simply because I think gerrymandering is so fundamental an issue to the health of our democracy. I needed to feel freed as a statewide elected official, as you noted, to be able to speak on what I think is a core issue to the fundamental health of our democracy. And I think gerrymandering is incredibly damaging because what it serves to do is to drive the elected officials to the extreme of their respective parties. The right goes right, the left goes left, and that's because they're worried about their next primary election, not their next general election. Just to underscore the disconnect, you noted in your introduction that North Carolina elected some Republicans, elected some Democrats. We're a 50-50 state. And heck, I won by 50.25%. So I know about a 50-50 state. Yet our congressional delegation is 77% Republican, 23% Democrat. Our state Senate is 70% Republican, 30% Democrat. There is no relationship between our representation and the will of the voters, and that is incredibly unhealthy for our democracy.
If there's bipartisanship anywhere, it is on the depth and gravity of the opioid crisis, and there you teamed up with a Republican to do something about it. Talk about that project.
Yeah, and there, we all get depressed by the state of our current politics, but there are issues where we are working together, and I think it's important for listeners to appreciate that while the media does focus a lot on what's broken, there is a lot that's working. And I want to commend the representatives and senators. I mean, on the Senate, there was Jim Davis, Tom McGinnis, Bill Rabin, all Republicans. On the House, you had Craig Horn, Ted Davis. You had Representative Greg Murphy, all Republicans. And they worked with me. We sat down and we went through a whole host of ideas about what North Carolina can be doing to attack this crisis that's killing people. And we came up with a very strong solution in the STOP Act, which I'm happy to describe, and the Synthetic Opioid Control Act. Both bills passed unanimously, meaning every Democrat, every Republican, and then the governor signed it into law.
Give us a summary.
Sure. The STOP Act is about reducing the number of people who become addicted to opioids in the first place. When you look at this crisis and how it's really exploded over the last 20 years, it is a function of overprescription of opioid painkillers. There is almost a one-to-one relationship in the dramatic increase in prescriptions to the dramatic increase in overdose deaths. So if we can get a handle on the overprescribing, we can turn the tide and reduce the number of people who are dying. If you look at internationally, the United States prescribes 10 times more opioids per capita than Japan, 4 times more per capita than Europe. There's just too many. There's a lot of explanations of how we got here, but that's a truth. And so what the STOP Act does is it sets a limit on the number of pills that a doctor can prescribe for acute pain as distinct from chronic pain. So if you have your wisdom teeth taken out, or you sprain your shoulder, or you break your foot, you can get a prescription, but it's capped at 5 days or 7 days for post-operative. That is going to reduce the number of excess pills. The way people get addicted, and it's primarily young people getting addicted, the majority of them, it's not from the prescription they get from the doctor. It's from their going into their parents' and their grandparents' medicine cabinets where there are extra pills just sitting there, and then they mess around with them. And they mess around with them on the weekend, and then before you know it, they're hooked.
Talk about, you also filed a lawsuit against a drug manufacturer that you had said had an extensive scheme to promote opioid prescriptions.
So the role of the drug companies is very complex. They're engaged in a ton of marketing. You have the drug manufacturers and the drug distributors. And while individual lives were being torn apart, people were dying, families suffering, communities struggling to deal with the burden in their emergency departments, in their county jails, and their social services. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cost of this epidemic is immense. The White House put it at $500 billion for 1 year for the whole country. So while all that was happening, the drug companies were making billions and billions and billions of dollars. We are investigating the drug manufacturers and the drug distributors to determine if they unlawfully created or fueled this crisis. And if I conclude that they have, I will hold them accountable. And as you noted, I've already sued one drug manufacturer. They had a fentanyl product. Fentanyl is insanely powerful, 100 times more potent than morphine. And this was a drug that goes under the tongue, which a doctor told me is essentially the same as shooting it into your vein. And they were marketing this to docs for pain. I mean, for back pain, not for cancer, which is what it was approved for. So we want to make sure they're held accountable for the damage they've done.
Josh Stein, Attorney General for the state of North Carolina, thank you so much for talking with us.
Frank, I enjoyed it.
Attorney General Josh Stein, you can find links to our conversation and his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to look back at the peacemaking efforts of the 20th century. Yes, there were some, and the lessons that can be learned. Stay tuned.